Part 8. Takeoff to touchdown. First, a word about your anxiety during the takeoff. Many people worry that the runway won't be long enough. Well, I've just explained that. Many people feel that the engines are straining. But the truth is that we probably are using only 90 to 95% of the plane's actual engine power. There's always plenty in hand. Many people don't like the noise during the takeoff. The reason that there's so much noise is that the soundproofing is designed to be most efficient at the cruising speed of 600 miles an hour, not at the speeds on the runway. And when you're travelling at 600 miles an hour, the noise is being left behind. At the start of the takeoff, you're surrounded by the noise of the engines. And what about the bumpy runway? The runway is designed with ridges and grooves in it to disperse water, and this makes a lot of tyre noise. Perhaps the runway isn't as smooth as your dining room table, but it's not helped by the fact that the wheels and shock absorbers are designed to transfer the weight of the aircraft from the wings to the wheels at 150 miles an hour when it's landing. This means that the springs and shock absorbers are very stiff, which doesn't make the ride very comfortable during the takeoff. But uncomfortable is not the same as dangerous, is it? In the cockpit of a modern aircraft, the pilots just have to press a button for the onboard computers to calculate exactly how much power the engines should produce for that particular takeoff. In the very, very unlikely event of an engine malfunction, after a certain speed, the aeroplane will always be able to take off and climb safely. And, of course, if there is an engine malfunction before this speed, the runway will be long enough for the aeroplane to be able to stop. This is not a matter of guesswork. It's calculated very carefully once the pilots know how heavy the aircraft is and which runway they're using. Remember, we calculated all that earlier. If your seat in the cabin is in front of the engines, then it will be less noisy than if you're sitting behind them. Probably the best place for an anxious passenger to sit is over the wings, because in that position you are in effect over the middle point of a seesaw, and the movements of the aircraft will be less noticeable in that position. As you will have noticed, when the aircraft is taxiing to the runway, you will have heard the noise of the flaps travelling into position. After the aircraft has been climbing for about a minute, the flaps will be retracted. If you're able to see the wings from your seat and you're looking out of the window when this is happening, you will see the panels at the front or back of the wing folding back into the wings to make them smaller as the plane gathers speed. After takeoff, the aircraft will probably level off at about 6,000 feet. This is the point when many anxious passengers tell me they feel as if they're falling. As I explained earlier, what you feel is not necessarily what is going on. The sudden change in sound as the engine power is reduced and the feeling of falling as the plane goes from being nose up to level will give you a distinct feeling of going down. At this point, you have to say to yourself, "I feel as if the aeroplane is going down, but I know it isn't." Just one more thing before we finish with the takeoff. Some people say to me they think it's possible for the plane to tip over when the nose goes up. They think it's possible for the nose to keep going up and up and up. This is just not possible, so please do not worry about this anymore if you've worried about it previously. It's no more possible than a car going round and round in circles just because you've turned left or right. An aeroplane is most likely to be in cloud during the climb up to its cruising altitude. This means that where the changes of speed and direction are occurring is most likely to be when you're unable to see out of the window. Don't let the sensations that you feel at this time worry you unnecessarily. I have already explained why you get these sensations. Just be prepared for them during the first part of the climb and during the last 10 minutes of the flight. As you climb up through the clouds, it's likely that you'll feel the bumps that are caused by them. The bumps occur when your aircraft flies through the air that is going up as it forms the clouds, and then down when the clouds disperse. Remember to have your seat belt fastened as tightly as you can bear it to reduce the feelings of being bumped around. With modern air traffic control systems, your climb to the cruising height will probably be uninterrupted. But if it is necessary to level out, you might hear the engine power reduce and then increase again as the aircraft is allowed to continue climbing. While we're talking about changes in engine noises, it's worth adding here that some people ask me why the engine noise will suddenly increase when they've been flying along for a few hours without anything else happening. Why has it suddenly become necessary to change the engine power? The reason for this is quite simple, and it's because as the plane uses fuel, it becomes lighter, which means that the aeroplane can climb higher, and this is beneficial in terms of speed and lower fuel consumption. Perhaps you're asking yourself, why hasn't he spoken about turbulence yet? The reason is that turbulence doesn't play a prominent part in a pilot's life. It's just part of the flight that may or may not occur, and there are no special things that we have to do because of it. During our pre-flight preparation, we will have checked for areas of turbulence, and of course, where possible, we'll take a route to avoid it. Weather maps predict exactly where these areas are and the times that it is likely to happen. As I'm sure you know, we never fly closer than 20 miles to any storm clouds, and modern weather radar equipment will show us exactly where the storms are. It is very easy to navigate around them. When in an area of turbulence, the captain is obliged to put on the seatbelt signs, and you are obliged to put your seatbelts on. You should tighten them as much as you can bear so that you move at the same time as the aeroplane rather than moments afterwards, which will always make the turbulence seem worse. A racing car driver is strapped in so tightly that only his arms and feet can move. Nowadays, even head movement is prevented by head restraints. This, surprisingly enough, is designed for safety and comfort. The same thing applies to you when you're strapped in tightly, safety and comfort. For the pilots, during turbulence, we reduce the speed to give the passengers the most comfortable ride possible. And that is all we have to do. It's not harder to fly a plane during turbulence any more than it's more difficult for you to drive over a bumpy road compared to a smooth one. You have no reason to be concerned about flying in turbulence despite what you think and what you feel. Remember, as long as you are strapped in tightly, you just have to tell yourself that turbulence is uncomfortable, but that's not the same as dangerous. Regard it as an inconvenience rather than a threat. There are extensive descriptions of turbulence both in the book Flying Without Fear and on our audio CD set. I know how worrying turbulence can be for you, and because it's such an important subject, I will repeat some of that information here. However, I will repeat once more that the aeroplane is perfectly safe despite how you feel. Maybe I should introduce the subject in the way that I would if I were flying. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is the captain. We're just approaching an area of turbulence, so I'd like you to return to your seats and fasten your seat belts. Reports from other aircraft say that the turbulence will last about 15 minutes. When we're clear, I shall turn off the seatbelt signs again. May I reassure you that although you might find turbulence uncomfortable, it presents no problems at all to the aircraft or how we fly it. When you hear this announcement, you should not become tense. Practice your relaxation and breathing exercises and tighten your seatbelt as much as you can. Say to yourself that turbulence is uncomfortable, but that's not the same as dangerous. The fact that turbulence is caused by moving air is a blindingly obvious fact, I think. But how does it get moved in the first place? Let's go from basic principles. The reason that it's hotter at the equator than at the north and south poles is that the sun's heating effect is greater at the equator than at the poles. You know that when you're sunbathing, it's better to enjoy the midday sun than the very early morning or evening sun, because at midday, the sun's rays hit you directly, while in the evening, they strike you at a very shallow angle. At the north and south poles, the sun strikes the planet Earth at such a shallow angle that very little heating occurs. Now then, the effect of this is for the air to rise at the equator. That air has to be replaced, so air travels from the poles towards the equator. Meanwhile, the air over the land is being heated more than the air over the sea. This means, for instance, that the air over Europe, Africa, or America will rise. This air is again replaced by air that had been over the sea. These circulations, north to south, south to north, and left to right across the planet, means that the air collides, and just like two rivers meeting, ripples and waves are caused. You just can't see them. Well, if only it were as simple as that. Now imagine a town in the country. What happens when the sun beats down on the town? Does the same thing happen when the sun beats down on the field surrounding the town? No, the effects are quite different. On a hot day, we know that when we go back to the car park to collect our car, that the surface of it can be very hot. And this is the same for the whole town. It heats up. Meanwhile, the fields don't heat up as quickly, so the hot air over the town rises, and it's replaced by the cooler air that was over the fields. Here, then, is another source of turbulence, because if you're flying along and the bubble of warm air rises from the town, you'll feel it as a bump. When that air has finished rising, perhaps hours later, it will have to come down again. And if you're in the vicinity, you'll feel that as another bump. Another cause of turbulence is when the wind strikes objects on the ground, such as trees, towns, and mountains. When this happens, the air rises on one side and then follows the shape of the ground and descends on the other side. As we know with streams and rivers, when the water flow hits an obstruction, the water doesn't flow continuously and smoothly. It forms ripples and currents and eddies. And this is exactly what happens to the wind. And you feel this as bumps and movements of the aeroplane. However uncomfortable you feel, as long as you're strapped in securely, you will come to no harm in turbulence. During turbulence, keep pulling your lap strap as tightly as you can bear it. The press have made a great deal about clear air turbulence, but then they make a great deal about a lot of things. Clear air turbulence, or CAT, is a specific description for turbulence and is caused at medium to high altitude and doesn't usually produce a cloud. You may find someone to make more of it than that, but that's all it is, really. I keep thinking that you won't be satisfied unless I cover everything I know about turbulence. But really and truly, there are very few variations in how turbulence is caused. What I have described are the main causes. What is most important for you to remember is to say to yourself that turbulence is uncomfortable, but that's not the same as dangerous. And if you wonder what causes turbulence, say to yourself it's because the heating is greater at the equator. And that should be enough, unless you want to go into a career in meteorology. Back to the flight. Once we're at the cruising height, we, the pilots, will be monitoring and implementing air traffic control instructions for the route. We'll be checking the weather and fuel consumption and monitoring the aircraft systems. It's important for you to know that the computers that perform these functions cannot be compared to your home PC. The demands on aircraft computers are far less than anything a personal computer has to do. And because they're duplicated and sometimes triplicated, then even if there is a fault on one, it doesn't affect the aircraft at all. Everything in the cockpit, every system on board, has at least one, two, or three backups, depending upon its importance. Before I describe what happens during the descent, approach, and landing, perhaps this would be a good time to learn something about breathing techniques and relaxation techniques in case you start to become anxious. Remember that before your flight, you should have rested well. You should have prepared everything in advance, found something to entertain yourself with during the flight, informed yourself about the facts of flying, and dispelled all those myths that used to worry you. You should have eaten well and drunk enough water to stay hydrated. If you've done all those things, the benefits of breathing properly and relaxing properly will be considerable. Let's look at these routines now. Breathing, relaxation, and visualizations. Throughout this course, you will have heard me and you will continue to hear me referring to breathing, relaxation, and visualization routines. I shall outline these very briefly and, as usual, leave you to find the ones that suit you. It is recognized by psychologists that if you can control your breathing, then you can control the symptoms and the onset of a panic attack. Here's what we suggest on our Fear of Flying course, and it's generally accepted as a suitable form of diaphragmatic breathing. We all know that at times of anxiety, our breathing becomes shallower and faster. This can sometimes lead to hyperventilation, which is when you get too much oxygen into your lungs and bloodstream. This can make you feel dizzy, and you may feel as if you're going to pass out or faint. You may feel some tingling in your fingers and toes. This breathing exercise can help you to avoid these symptoms. It is very simple. Breathe in through your nose for a count of 5 seconds. Hold your breath for 2 seconds, and then exhale through your mouth for 7 seconds. It's important to breathe in this way because you fill your lungs properly. When you breathe in, your stomach should expand, a bit like a balloon. It's helpful to place one hand on your stomach so that you can feel it moving properly. This is a very healthy way of breathing, as your lungs get as much air into them as possible, and the mixture of oxygen and other gases will be used properly. I recommend you to practice this method daily. Then you will be able to go into this technique quickly and properly whenever you become anxious. There are recommendations about how you sit when you start to practice this, but I shall leave you to find your own information on this subject. Your daily exercise need only last for around 5 minutes or so, and the great thing about this technique is that you can practice it, or indeed implement this in your daily life, without drawing attention to yourself. Remember, you can't panic when you're concentrating on your breathing. Let's have a look now at relaxation exercises. We all know that when we're feeling anxious, it's difficult to relax. Here's a technique to practice at home. You'll need to rest on a firm surface, such as a bed or floor. Start with relaxing your toes. You then move on to the feet and relax all the muscles in your feet. Then you should consciously relax all the muscles in your body, moving slowly up through your ankles, legs, hips, and so on. This very simple exercise takes time and effort, so it's important to have some time alone where your environment is quiet and free from interruption. If you fall asleep while doing this, you can assume that it's worked for you. In a way, it's a form of meditation, so you'll need to try to empty your mind of thoughts such as household chores, anxiety, and anything else that's stressing you. Using the diaphragmatic breathing technique at the same time will help you to relax. When you do this, every time you're feeling good, you will send a positive message to your brain. Now, curiously, a technique that I use when I can't sleep is to do the opposite to begin with, and then to relax afterwards. So it works for me when I tense my muscles from my toes very slowly up to my neck and even my face muscles. Then I hold myself in the state of tension for about 5 seconds and then relax from my eyebrows very, very slowly down to my toes. You're supposed to do this 6 times and you'll be asleep. I've never completed more than 3 cycles. Like I keep saying, do something that works for you. Finally, visualizations. Very simple. You just think of a peaceful and enjoyable place and go there in your mind. It's probably better to choose a place where it's peaceful in itself and where your memories of it can make it even more peaceful. Practice going there in your mind as much as you can. Only practice these routines when you have time and are in a safe environment, because the idea is for you to associate peace and calm with them, and when you're beginning, you'll need as few distractions as possible. Think of places rather than people. This routine is not the same as the visualizations required for some of the psychological therapies, which suggest that you imagine yourself as a fearless flyer and are able to do whatever you want with regard to flying. No, this is a very simple, calming, and quiet process to reduce anxiety. Nothing more. Now, most importantly, make these routines a part of your daily life so that you can employ them quickly and effectively whenever you need to reduce your anxiety or when you want to remain calm. However, these are methods to help you to face your fear along with knowledge and confidence. They are not a cure in themselves. We'll go back to the flight in just a few moments, but let's enjoy a few moments of peace and quiet while you think of breathing, relaxing, and visualizing. Hi, and welcome back. While you've been doing your breathing, relaxation, and visualization exercises, the co-pilot and I have been navigating towards our destination. Once we settle at our cruising height, the flight navigation equipment follows the prescribed route and takes us safely to our destination. I doubt, though, whether you would want us to trust this equipment without checking it, and that's exactly what we do. Throughout the flight, we monitor what the flight computer suggests and make adjustments if necessary. During the cruise, we check that there are suitable airfields around in case we need to land. I know that many fearful flyers think that when they're over the sea, that it wouldn't be possible to make an emergency landing. But there's less to this than you'd think. The first thing to say is that an emergency to a fearful passenger is not what I would call an emergency. If something happens during a flight that requires me to make a landing, then that's all there is to it. It's not an emergency as such. It's just that I'm doing something that I hadn't previously planned for. If an engine were to malfunction while I'm over the sea, contrary to what you might think, I don't have to make a landing straight away. The aeroplane is perfectly capable of flying to its destination on the remaining engines. So from my point of view, it doesn't matter if there is an airfield near me or not. I can continue to the destination anyway. On a two-engined aircraft over the sea, a flight has to be within a certain flying time of suitable airports at which to land. This means that the route will be slightly different from a jumbo going to the same destination. So, before the flight leaves, the weather forecast at these extra airports has to be very good. Once again, the media exaggerate the problems and risks unnecessarily with regard to aeroplanes flying over the sea. Remember that modern air travel is very different from the air travel of just a few years ago. The advances in aircraft reliability, design, and safety are far greater than those of the motor car and the road systems. Air travel is the safest form of transport. What else are the pilots doing during the cruise? We're liaising with the cabin crew about the welfare of the passengers and checking the weather, and all the time I'm in touch with air traffic control, who are supervising the flight. As we approach our destination, the co-pilot and I will discuss the landing procedure and program the computers for the expected arrival procedure. We discuss and agree the different heights to which we can go down when we leave our cruising height and descend towards the runway. During the descent, sometimes air traffic control asks us to increase the speed at which we're descending. Occasionally, this means that we have to use the speed brakes. The speed brakes are large panels that come out of the top surface of the wing to disrupt the smooth air flowing over the wing. This reduces the lift and the aircraft will descend more quickly. We are never asked to plummet more quickly. The result of using the speed brakes also means that the aircraft will vibrate more than it does usually, and this is because of that disrupted airflow I just mentioned. As we get lower and lower, we have to use the flaps and put the wheels down. Both of these things will slow the aeroplane down, which we counteract by increasing the engine power. To a nervous flyer, all these noises and movements will be unsettling and unexpected. So, when this is happening on your flight, describe to yourself in unemotive language precisely what is happening and why it is happening. If you do become anxious, breathe deeply and use your relaxation techniques. Once again, I have to use the expression despite what you think. And, despite what you think, flying a modern jet airliner is not a difficult or demanding task. It certainly requires special skills, but not special people to perform them. After all, it is just a job. It is a very privileged and a very specialized job, but it is still just a job. And the people doing it do all the things that other people do when they finish their jobs. They go home, they greet the family, feed the dog, fix a tap, cut the grass, and watch the television. There are no supermen or superwomen flying aeroplanes. This is an important thing to remember, because if you believe that only super people can fly aeroplanes, then you will also believe that there must be a special reason for that. And that reason would be connected with difficulty and danger. This is simply not true. Many people that I've taken on a flight simulator are amazed to see how quickly and easily they can learn to control a passenger aircraft. I often hear reports from nervous passengers that the landing was bumpy, or that the plane was too fast, or landed too far along the runway, or nearly missed the taxiway, or got lost, nearly landed on another aircraft, and many, many other exaggerated claims about the landing. All these things are possible, because anything is possible, but it is highly improbable. It's impossible to tell any of these things without actually being in the cockpit. And I have to say that none of these things has ever happened to me. These are perceptions that people have when they are in a hypervigilant state and being driven by anxiety. It's no more likely that a pilot would do these things than it would be for you to drive the wrong way along the road. And never forget that it's not just one person flying the plane. The co-pilot and captain will be supervising the actions of the other. What is the probability of one of them doing it incorrectly without the other one noticing it? Don't focus on what could happen. Think about what does happen successfully millions of times every year. Let me quickly tell you how to land a jet aeroplane. We have equipment on board which will show us exactly the height that we should be at as we approach the runway. The same equipment shows us whether we're in line with the runway, which of course we may not be able to see because of cloud or fog. Not only does this equipment show whether we're in line or not, but it will also tell us how to get back to the correct height and alignment. We control the speed during the approach with the throttles just as you do in a car, except they are operated by hand and there's one lever for each engine. A different lever with four or five positions allows us to set the flaps as we need them when we slow down. Remember that as we set the flaps, although they allow us to fly slowly, they also disturb the airflow, which you'll feel as a vibration in the cabin. The same will happen in the cabin when I put the wheels down. With the speed set correctly and with my instrument showing me where I am in relation to the runway, I now wait until I'm about 40 feet above the runway, where I raise the nose very slightly. When I've done that, I close the throttles and the aeroplane will sink onto the runway. If it's wet, I will allow the aircraft to touch down more firmly to squeeze the water out of the tyres so that I can brake without skidding. Once on the ground, I increase the braking effect with the engines by selecting reverse thrust. This blows the air from the back of the engines forwards instead of backwards, so that it helps the aircraft to slow down. I know that it makes a lot of noise, but it is a very efficient way of slowing the plane. When I've slowed to about 60 miles an hour, I can turn off the runway and go to the parking gate. On the way to the gate, once again, you will hear noises of the flaps going back into position and more air conditioning noises. Usually, some of the engines are stopped while we're taxiing, so it's possible that you will see the lights going on and off as the electrical supplies change as they did on startup. That's the end of the short description about flight, so let's now go back and look at some more things that you can do to overcome your fear of flying.